Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com.
But the way in which social class, as in money, like hard and fast money, shapes how students navigate college down to the basic necessities during breaks, we haven't talked about that before.
Hey, y'all, I'm Tommy Tomlinson, and from WFAE in Charlotte, this is Southbound. The voice you just heard belongs to a young man named Tony Jack. I met Tony 10 years ago when I was on a fellowship at Harvard. It was the first day of a sociology class I was taking, and Tony walked in looking like an NFL lineman, tall and thick and wearing a tracksuit. Then the professor had us introduce ourselves, and about 10 seconds after Tony started talking, I knew he was the smartest one in the class. He has spent his life outperforming expectations. He's made it from a poor neighborhood in Miami to his own job now teaching at Harvard. And he's written a book called The Privileged Poor about the realities of class divisions at elite universities. We talk about his book, his life, and his thoughts on the recent college admissions scandal. Here's our conversation. So, Tony Jack, I met you, I guess, 10 or 11 years ago. You were a grad student at Harvard. You had been a student at Amherst, went through Harvard, and now you're teaching at Harvard. But could you tell the folks listening a little bit about where and how you grew up?
Yeah. I am originally from Miami, Florida. As a matter of fact, my first plane ride ever in life was from Miami to Amherst when they found me. I'm a first-generation college student. I start there because that's a huge part of my identity. You know, my mother is a security guard at a middle school. My brother's a janitor. My grandmother was a maid. You know, everybody was hardworking, but no one had a chance to go to college in the way that I did. I'm from Coconut Grove, specifically West Grove. That's important because there's literally a street that separated the community where all the black residents lived on one side and the white residents lived on the other. And that really shaped my upbringing because the only reason why I went to the schools that I did was because I was also a Head Start kid. And so I got a chance to go to the school that was across the tracks in elementary school. So I went to Coconut Grove instead of Francis S. Tucker. And that put me on a different trajectory. So I start with those things because those are all little pieces of me that the more I spend time at Harvard and reflect on my time at Amherst, I actually go back to those moments. What does it mean for me to be a Head Start kid, to have grown up in West Grove, to be the son of a security guard, the grandson of a maid, to be sitting in Harvard with, you know, the Harvard robe on my desk, I mean, on my wall as a Harvard professor. And I just think about how improbable that journey is.
Yeah, and so I know, and this is a distinction that will become important when talking about your book. Mm-hmm. You ended up spending part of your high school years, or at least 1 year, at a private school in Miami. Right?
Yes.
How did that happen?
Yeah. I had a football coach in high school who liked athlete students and not student athletes. And I should say, you know, in Florida, you know, football is huge. Not to the same extent in other southern states, but football is still big. And I went to school with Frank Gore, who is still, you know, running back. He was running back for the San Francisco 49ers, the Miami Dolphins, Indianapolis Colts. Went to school with Jonathan Vilma and played with them. But football for me was a hobby. Like, it was something to do after school rather than something I wanted to orient my life around. You know, I was an IB kid. I was a nerd. I was a big, chubby nerd. And I own that. And football was just something to do after school because it kept me out of trouble and it kept me active in a way that I otherwise would not have been. And I had the best game of my life against Northwestern Senior High School at Trask Powell Stadium, but my shoulder came out when I tackled the running back in the backfield. A couple of weeks later, he kicked me off the team right when I found out I had to have surgery, he really did not like me and like the fact that I took, I did not put football first. I put school first. And so I switched schools because I didn't want someone else to determine when I stopped playing football. Not saying that it was my life, but I didn't want to be told that after investing 3 years of summer workouts and winter workouts in Miami during the summer, during the fall when it's humid. Like, I gave up a lot for it. I didn't want someone else to tell me. And that's how I ended up at Gulliver Preparatory.
And how did, I don't mean to sound weird about this, but how did you, were they accommodating you because of your football skills or because of your academic record or both? Or how did that work out?
It was a combination of both. Yeah, it was definitely a combination of both. Because I was a scholarship kid, which meant that I was on a full ride at the school, but I was also in their international baccalaureate program, which was actually kind of rare for their scholarship students. It was a rare combination of to be in the most intellectual community of international baccalaureate students at the school, but also to be on scholarship and playing football for the school.
Mm-hmm. And then how did Amherst find you from there?
It actually fit in with the research in the end. Amherst has a relationship with a number of schools across the country. And even though they don't visit all of them, sometimes they will just give a call and say something simple as, hey, do y'all have somebody who can make it past our admissions test this year? And that is actually how they found me. The coach called my coach and said, hey, guys, you got anybody who can pass our test this year? The admissions criteria, that is. And my coach said, you know what? We got a guy who's pretty smart. We got somebody this year. When I entered Amherst, I asked myself a question. I was like, where are all the other poor black folks? Because everybody around me was talking about, oh, I studied abroad in Spain for a year. I summered on a private island. I have been to the floor seats of the Chicago Bulls. I remember seeing Michael Jordan play when I was really, really young. I'm thinking that those are very expensive things. Those are things I never even thought of in some respects. And people are just saying it as if it's nothing. I thought I was surrounded by rich people, black, white, Latinx, Asian. I thought everybody was rich and I was the only poor black person. But then I discovered just how many of my peers were talking about experience that they had because of their high school peers. How many of them studied abroad because their high school has a study abroad program? How many of them went to private islands because their classmate owned it?
And so it's a demographic group that's really not been studied that much before.
And especially not separately from one another. And what I mean by that is, when I started doing this research, all the research treated lower income students as one group, as an undifferentiated group. They were like, okay, if your parents didn't go to college or you came from a poor background, you have this one experience. And my research was counter to that, because the students who went to prep schools had experiences that were more similar to their affluent peers. The study abroad, they were taught by PhDs. And I call these students the privileged poor because they were economically poor, right? They didn't have money, but they had high stocks of cultural capital. They know what office hours are. They feel comfortable talking to adults. They know about Martha's Vineyard and they know about all the vacation spots. They've been to study abroad programs and know multiple languages and know the hidden streets of Paris. And I call them the privileged poor because it has an oxymoronic quality, right? Like, it's like jumbo shrimp, right? How can someone be both privileged and poor? And I wanted people to interrogate that. But I also called their peers, like poor students who did not go to prep school, but who attended typically distressed public schools that are underfunded, overcrowded, and under-resourced, the doubly disadvantaged. And again, a loaded term, but I wanted people to understand this experience beyond individual differences.
So explain how you did the research for this. You spent some time on a campus, right?
Yes. I interviewed 103 black, white, and Latinx undergraduates and did 2 years of ethnographic observation at an elite university in the Northeast. I want to stop you there
because you don't name it and you change the names of the students and that sort of thing too. And that's sort of par for the course in academic research.
Yes. And part of the reason is because some universities will only allow you to do a study on their campus if there's some kind of anonymity, either for mostly it's usually for the students, but some universities also require it of the university itself. And so every student name is a pseudonym, though I personally ask every student to give me their pseudonym so that they can have some ownership of this process with me.
I was wondering about that because there's a Beyonce in there.
Yeah, there is a Beyonce in there. and she chose that name. And she was like, I want to know, not only because she is a member of the Beehive, like she really does love Beyonce, but she also said, I wanted to find myself in your book. And I told them at the time, thank you for the vote of confidence because, you know, I was a graduate student. I had no idea it would actually become, you know, a book at the time because it was very early. You know, it was more of me trying to graduate. But students chose names that meant something to them. And they told me the story of what the names were. Some people's names were family members that they lost. Some people's names were names that meant something culturally. Like I had one student who was Afro-Latino, and the name that she chose was Ogun. And that meant something to her and her family. And so I wanted to invite students in on the process every step of the way. And I did 2 years of ethnographic observation because I also, you know, I'm an interviewer, but at the same time, I too was walking around campus and they started inviting me to events and moderating events. And so I was able to not just provide how they saw the world, but also some texture to the world that they saw throughout the book.
So a couple of things that as a student who came from a family without much means, these still struck me as things that I didn't think about or know about. One, and you mentioned this about a few minutes ago, was the idea of office hours and what they mean. Could you sort of explain the fraughtness of that and how different people approached it?
Office hours, at its most basic, is a set of time that professors are required to meet with students, blocks of time that professors make themselves available to students. What I just did there is almost never done on a college campus.
You mean just explaining what it means?
Exactly. When professors mention office hours, often only on the first day of class, they almost always say when they are. They never say what they are. I can't tell you how many times I've heard the following statement. Tony, I've been teaching for 40 years, and until hearing this or reading your book, I've never thought to define office hours. See, we assume, especially at elite schools that have traditionally recruited students, not only from affluent families, but also those who attended prep schools, we assume that everyone knows certain things. We assume that just saying office hours and when they are is enough information for students to go on. And that's fundamentally first of all, it's a wrong assumption to make. But think about who it hurts. What if you went to a school where the average teacher-student ratio was 40 and those teachers were overtaxed because they were more often maintaining order than making connections? All of a sudden, go to class, and a professor says, "Oh, come to my office hours 2 to 4 on Wednesdays, and we can, and that's all that they say." What are you supposed to do? Who feels comfortable going to office hours? And so, who knows? Like, it's not just who knows what office hours are and who feels comfortable in them, but who knows how to navigate them. Because you just don't want to go to someone's office and sit in a chair and just look at them and not know what to do. And so a lot of students for whom office hours is brand new, they don't go. And then if they do go, they are often the last to do so much later in the semester. But here's the rub. Office hours are oftentimes the best place to make connections with faculty members. That's the way in which you get those invitations to be someone's research assistant. That's how you get invited to dinners. But that's also how you get to know someone and that they get to know you so that they can be your support networks when things go wrong. Because everyone has those bad days, and some people have bad weeks or bad months in college because of life. But if you don't have a support network to help you through that, because no one knows you and no one knows what you're going through, you see what I'm saying? Like it starts snowballing very quickly. I'll give you a story that really made me stop and think about, and I was like, I have to be more intentional with this. A dean called me one day, and she asked me, "Hey Tony, I'm trying to increase academic engagement, you know, like more contact with faculty among my first gen and lower income students." And I said, "You know what? How about a suggestion for? I got a suggestion for you." I said, "Define office hours and get more faculty to do so on the first day of class, so that students know what they are and the kind of relationship that faculty want to see with office hours." She said, "Tony, you know, your comment made me think about something. I finally asked my students why they don't come visit me in office hours. You know what she said? She said her students let her know that we thought, they said, it was your time to do work. That was a time that you can't be disturbed because you said that those were your office hours."
Right. It sounds almost like the opposite of what it's supposed to be.
Exactly. Something was lost in translation that had nothing to do with English proficiency. Office hours is a very classed term. If you are not familiar with the college campus or you didn't go to a certain type of high school, you've probably never heard the term.
I also was struck by the idea of what students do on spring break and specifically what students do and don't eat on spring break. Could you describe that a little bit?
Yes. Colleges assume not just what students know, but what they can afford. And sadly, one of the most common practices during spring break is that colleges shut down. So used to educating children from the top 10% of the income distribution, many colleges shut down all eateries and even some dorms. When I was doing my research, even the colleges that have the most expansive financial aid packages, only one in five stayed open during spring break. A number of schools actually charge students upwards of $200 a week to stay in their own room during spring break, and one college actually changes the locks on the door to prevent students from staying in their dorms during spring break. And what students did during spring, the lower income students, it hurt to hear the stories, because one student stole food from his own cafeteria, and that made him feel a certain type of way about, I'm stealing from my own home to survive. One student fainted in her room because she was only able to afford one meal a day as she worked extra hours at her on-campus job. Another student increased her online dating activity in the weeks leading up to spring break because she was banking on gendered norms of older men paying for the first date, that she treated OkCupid as if it was DoorDash.
And you have to admit that the strategy there is pretty brilliant. I mean, it's sad, the reasoning, but the actual figuring that out, there's a real cleverness behind that.
Yes. I mean, desperate times often calls for desperate measures, and if you grew up poor, you know how to make ends meet in a myriad of ways that sometimes you want to talk about it and sometimes you don't. But that's just, it's very, very real for students. But here's the part that gets me is, even though I'm focusing on lower income students, what about the students who don't have a home to go to? We have an increasing number of students in the foster care system who are coming to college. What are they supposed to do during spring break with the assumption that they leave? What about those students who know that home and harm are synonymous? Because everybody knows relationships with family are not always good and not always healthy, let alone for international students who face issues of time in going home, even if they can't afford to at times. in highlighting how food insecurity, the way in which students don't know where their next meal is coming from, in attaching that to the calendar, I opened the door to show how class and culture matter on a college campus in a way that hadn't been done before, in the sense that we usually focus on interpersonal interactions. Who feels comfortable interacting with faculty? You know, that's a social thing. But the way in which social class, as in money, like hard and fast money, shapes how students navigate college down to the basic necessities during breaks, we haven't talked about that before. It's been talked about in common rooms. It's been talked about among lower income and first generation college students. But in the literature, people aren't talking about, people had before this, hadn't talked about spring break as a money issue of basic necessities and access to basic necessities. They only talked about it in the sense of how I feel when my friends are going off for vacation, not what it feels like to go hungry. And those are two very different investigations.
When we come back, Tony Jack talks about his reaction to the college admissions scandal. As you might imagine, he's got some thoughts. That and more ahead on Southbound.
Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com.
For our listeners in the Charlotte area, I want to let you know about an event we're doing on Saturday, May the 4th. For months, WFAE has been searching for the Charlotte area's next great podcast idea. We've received hundreds of submissions and almost 100,000 votes from the public. And now it's time to crown the winner of the Queen City PodQuest. Which idea will win a cash prize and a podcast development deal with WFAE? Find out at the PodQuest Live finale, Saturday at the NASCAR Hall of Fame. Tickets and more information are at wfae.org/QueenCityPodQuest. I'll be there. Come join us. And if you'd like to be a bigger part of the Southbound community, we'd love to hear from you. You can suggest ideas for future guests on our homepage at wfae.org/southbound. You can also email me directly at ttomlinson@wfae.org or tweet at me at Tommy Tomlinson. What really helps is if you leave us a good rating and review on Apple Podcasts or the NPR One app. That helps Southbound get out there to even more listeners. Thanks for all your support. Now, back to our conversation with Tony Jack. So now, you've obviously been on these campuses for a while. Is it easy for you to spot a kid in your classroom or maybe just on campus who falls into either of these categories?
I think it's easier for me to spot through either the questions that they may ask or if I'm observing behavior, it's easier to spot the doubly disadvantaged than the other two. And one of the reasons is because the privileged poor and those from middle or upper middle class backgrounds behave more similarly to one another than the doubly disadvantaged. Like when students enter my office hours, just how they enter and how comfortable they are with taking ownership of the space, how they sit. Do they apologize for knocking on my door? Do they just come on in? And like those like little subtle differences, I'm able to notice more who's doubly disadvantaged and who's not. But sometimes, as many faculty have told me, I've had this student in my class for 2 years, and I thought she was, you know, one of those upper middle class students, and it turned out that she lives in the housing projects, but she went to Andover on scholarship. I cannot tell you how many times I've heard that story of someone emailing me or calling me in their office to tell me that they finally had a person confirm or rather, in some respects, refute their assumption that they were upper middle class, only to realize that they were a member of the privileged poor.
And do you find that you or these students you've written about do a lot of code switching. Like they speak and talk and act in one particular way when they're around the more, you know, advantaged students, and in a different way when they are around students who maybe had similar backgrounds to them.
The thing is, I saw all my students code switch. The rich, the poor, the privileged poor, the disadvantaged, the upper middle class, like everyone code switched. How they were in the dorms as compared to in the cafeteria, where people were, where things were more public, to where they were in class or in their affinity groups. I think the privileged poor and the upper middle class students were more comfortable and more immediate in being polished in public forums that were more academic or public. And what I mean by public forum that are public, meaning public forums that are hosted by the school, where any and everybody can come, rather than public forums that are hosted by affinity groups, where it's like a more targeted population. The privileged poor and the doubly disadvantaged felt much more, sorry, the privileged poor and their upper middle class peers were much more comfortable being on than the doubly disadvantaged.
So I also want to ask about the dynamics between these students and their families and friends back home. Did you get a sense from them that, you know, that their families and friends kind of understand what's going on in their lives? Did they ever feel a sense of resentment or anything because of these kids who have made it into this different world? You know, the saying that I always heard growing up in Georgia was, you know, don't get above your raising. Well, these kids are obviously in a place that maybe none of them expected to be. And I just wonder what that dynamic is like back home.
I think all first-generation college students deal with having to explain a lot to one's family about what's going on. But I also think, especially first-generation college students, we also hide a lot of what's going on campus, because for our families, we're the ones who made it. For our families, we are the smartest people in the world to them, the most hardworking. So we hide sometimes the struggle that we face in college. And so that begins an extra source of stress, because as students become anxious about what's going on campus, they have to perform a certain level of ease when they talk to their families. And so that becomes hard. Now, what I will say is the privileged poor's parents, especially those who boarded, are a bit more prepared for college than their other peers' parents, right? Because if you went to a boarding school, you're used to your child being away from home. And college is boarding school year 5, 6, 7, and 8, right? And I did hear that. And I did see that to a certain extent. Yes, college is a big achievement, is a big adjustment. But when your child has been away for 4 years already, you yourself are a little bit accustomed to trying to figure out how to manage that kind of relationship.
So what are some ways to make this better for obviously the students first, and then the institutions as well, to make sure that the kids they get there have their best chance to succeed?
One of the things that, and I know to some people in the policy world, they're like, Tony, that doesn't answer the question, but it answers it for me. We have to move from access to inclusion, right? We focus so much on how students get in, who gets in, and where they're getting in from, that we have not paid significant attention to what happens when they get to campus, right? That's, to me, is the first step. We have to move from access to inclusion. The second thing, and one that is fundamental to a reorienting of how we think about higher education, we have to question what we take for granted. We have to question all the assumptions that we make about not just what students know, but what students can afford. And I mean that especially at colleges that are diversifying their campuses with lightning speed in the context of how old these institutions are. right? Vassar doubled its number of Pell Grant eligible students. So students who live within a certain range of the poverty line in a very short period of time. Especially when you think about these institutions are almost 200, 300, 400 years old, right? In a very short period of time. But how much has their policies on campus changed to welcome those students? Amherst did the same thing. Now upwards of 1 out of 5 of their students come from lower income backgrounds. But these are the same campuses that still had their dining halls closed because, again, assuming that all students leave for fun in the sun. These are the campuses that still don't define office hours. And I know some people may say, well, defining office hours won't get rid of poverty. That's not what it's intending to do. But it is defining, but this push to define office hours is intended to get us to think about what are the other things that trip students up because they only work for a very advantaged group. Like, how many times has anyone heard the term ad drop? Right? That doesn't mean anything for many people, but ad drop is a specific period of time in which students can add or drop a course without penalty. Think about how many students would have benefited from understanding what ad drop meant instead of suffering through a course that they end up failing. Or, on the other side, dropping a course but doing so after the penalty, after the period of time, and assessing either a financial penalty or an academic one. But if we don't take the time to explain these things and be intentional about our communication with students, you see what I'm saying? Like, it starts us to have a new orientation, a new mindset about how higher education works.
I do want to go back to admissions just a minute. Right about the time your book came out, this whole college admissions scandal broke with many wealthy kids, or the kids of wealthy parents, got basically backdoored into many of these elite universities, maybe even the one you studied, I don't know. As a kid who went to a non-elite school, this really makes me furious. And I'm wondering what you think about it.
What happens in the dark comes into light eventually. And that's the first thought that I had. Because what happened in this scandal confirmed a lot of the suspicions that we all had, that the wealthy play a different game when it comes to college admissions. But I liken this scandal to the tip of the iceberg. One, because it's the tip of the iceberg that we actually see, and this just happened to be something that broke the surface and showed us how ugly and unequal it is. But we also know that the most dangerous part of an iceberg is what's still submerged underwater. This is opportunity hoarding 101. This is wealthy parents taking every chance to hoard resources for their children because they believe that they have proprietary ownership of all that is good. And they use their wealth to exploit every avenue through which to hold on to every valuable thing that we hold dear. It annoyed me in so many ways, and I'm trying to be as calm about it as possible, because these people stole spots. Yet, when I got into Amherst, when I got to Amherst, when I got into Harvard, when I accepted the job at Harvard, I was told that I took somebody who was more deserving spot. I was called an affirmative action baby or an affirmative action hire, as if I didn't earn the spot, I was given it just because of who I was. And these are people who have invested millions of dollars in creating and curating this perfect child. They live in neighborhoods that are safe. They live in neighborhoods that give them resources, that have parks. They can run at midnight or at noon and still feel safe. They went to schools that are more resourced than some colleges. They hired tutors for SAT that costs $500 to $1,000 an hour. They hired people to edit, and I'm doing bunny ears around edit because they actually wrote their essays for school. And yet, when poor students like myself make it to college, they paternalistically say, oh, he's overmatching. He's going to a school that's above his academic punching weight. Who's overmatching when you can't even make it in on your own merit, if merit is even a possibility in this system? You're telling me that you had someone take the test for you. You had someone write your essays for you. And you went to the best schools that your parents' money can buy, and you still couldn't get in on your own. You had to cheat. You had to bribe doctors to give you fake diagnoses when other Americans are forced to use emergency rooms as primary care physicians. And you're telling me you earned your spot? The only spot they earned was their spot in jail, which was where I hope they end up.
I want to ask one last thing, Tony. So you've been in this world now. I was sort of back counting in my head as we talked. Maybe half your life, 16, 17 years now from prep school through Amherst, through Harvard, and now teaching at Harvard. Mm-hmm. Do you still feel twinges of those things that the students you interviewed felt? Do you ever have those feelings that, you know, maybe I don't belong here, or these other people here have things that I could never achieve, or any of those doubts and fears that may come into some of those students' minds?
Yes. There are always things that will always be new to me. I told you that my first flight was a Delta flight from Miami to Amherst. My first international flight was in 2011 when I went to London for a conference. And so when people started talking about, you know, going through multiple passport books before they expire, you're like, whew, that's a lot of stamps, right? You know, to run out of passport pages?
Yeah, I've got like three, yeah.
Right. but also I flip it. I don't want to get to a point where I take certain things for granted. Like, I'm on a book tour now, and I'm using it as my college book tour because I couldn't afford to do one when I was a college junior and senior, right? Like, I'm going to campus, and I'm snapping selfies with the mascots. I'm looking around when I'm supposed to be the person who's the expert giving talks. I'm like, you know what? Let this first gen have his moment, please. because I do want that unofficial college tour where I just wander around campus sometimes and find that nook in those hidden spaces and talk to the janitor or the security guard about his or her experience of being in this place, because I still do feel very comfortable and sometimes more comfortable with the janitor or with the security guard, especially if it's a person of color, than I do some of the faculty members who are there just to question, you know, like, did you do this research technique that I found it in 14, you know, I found in this book, right? And so, like, I'm enjoying myself. And so there are moments that people talk about, you know, doing things, I'm just like, wow, that's wow for me. But there were some things that were still painful. There were a number of times that tears rolled when I was writing the process, because I re-listened to every single interview that I'd conducted as I was taking notes on people's experiences. And it brought up painful memories for me. You know, I've seen crackheads get their heads split open with cinder blocks. I've seen people fight in the middle of the street with broken bottles and cut each other. I've seen... You know, I know what it means to know the difference between firecrackers and gunshots. And when students start to mention those same things, I mean, those wounds I don't think ever really heal. And sometimes my students' words just, quite frankly, open them up for me. I am more affected by the stories and experiences of my fellow first-gen students than the very high-class elite experiences of my wealthy peers, because I know the emotions and the experience behind those memories.
Most of the time, Tony Jack is a cheerful guy. You probably heard the undercurrent in his voice when he was talking about the college admissions scandal. We seem to have this notion in our country that people with money have it because they deserve it, and people without money are somehow undeserving. A lot of times that's not even true on the face of it. The world is filled with rich swindlers, and poor folks who are guilty of nothing but catching bad breaks. But beyond that, in this particular scandal, we're talking about kids. Kids who had nothing to do with the money or lack of it that their parents might have had. Colleges are doing a lot better than they used to at finding the Tony Jacks of the world. But some of those kids are still getting squeezed out in favor of rich children who don't belong there. That makes it harder for our society to ever become anything close to equal. And that's the anger I think you hear in Tony Jack's voice. Southbound is a production of WFAE in Charlotte. Our producer is Nick Della Canal. Our web manager is Jessa O'Connor. Our audience engagement manager is Joni Deutsch. And our main theme music comes from Josh Turner. You can listen to this and other episodes of Southbound on the NPR One app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever else you like to listen to podcasts. You can also find Southbound on WFAE.org, where each episode has show notes with more information on that week's guest. See y'all next time. Thanks for listening.
Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com. Additional support is provided by the Knight Foundation.